This is G'day World 325. You're listening to the Podcast Network. My name is Cameron Riley. Welcome to the show. This is an interview I actually recorded back in March 2008, just before I left Melbourne. And then one thing led to another. TPN got hacked and I moved to Brisbane and stuff and kind of completely forgot about it, actually, until I got an email from the guy I interviewed, Jonathan Oxer, this morning, saying, hey, what happened to that interview that we did? And I went, oh, yeah, shit, I better dig that out and put it up. It's quite a fascinating story. Jonathan's had a lot of press. If you live in Australia, you've probably heard of this guy in the last couple of months. A couple of years ago, he implanted an RFID chip in his arm and now uses it to control a whole bunch of things inside of his house. So I caught up with him, went down and had a visit, had a look at everything and how it works. We had a chat about how he did it, why he did it, where he thinks this sort of technology is going in the future, those sorts of things. There's also some accompanying video with this. If you haven't seen it already, jump up to the blog post on g'dayworld.com and you'll see a link to 5 or 6 minutes of video that I put up on YouTube this morning as well. So, look, really fascinating chat. I remember reading 10, 12 years ago, there was a professor, university professor in England called Kevin Warwick, I think his name was, and he implanted a chip in his arm similar to what Jonathan's done. But it's something I've been fascinated with for a long time. I can think of a whole bunch of applications. You know, one of the things that annoys me is keys. It's 21st century, you know, we're all carrying around this pocket full of little metal objects that we use to get into our car, to get into our house. You know, I have 4 or 5 keys for my house, a couple for, you know, wooden doors, security screen doors, garage doors. I've got keys for my car, all this kind of stuff. It's ridiculous. You know, there's got to be a better way of doing this, and you know, perhaps this is it. Perhaps we all walk around with a little chip inside of us to let ourselves into all of these things. Not to mention authentication into PCs or authentication into ATMs or mobile phones, so if they get lost or stolen, you don't have to worry about people using them for illicit purposes, etc., etc. And then there's obviously, you know, whole things about tracking, which we've used RFID in animals for years, and there's been some talk in the last few years of putting it into kids. But, you know, if people get kidnapped or kids get lost or run away from home, to be able to track them with an RFID chip seems like a good idea to me as a parent. I know there are privacy issues and all that kind of stuff, but surely you could get a court order to allow you to track your missing child with an RFID chip if they went missing or they got kidnapped or whatever. Anyway, here's Jonathan Oxer. Hope you enjoy it. All right, I'm sitting in the home of Jonathan Oxer. Welcome to the show, Jonathan.
Thank you, Cameron.
Out in Croydon South in Melbourne. Now, you've had quite a bit of press recently.
Mm.
Tell people why you've had a lot of press. What have you done to yourself?
Okay, well, it's actually a little bit odd because what I did was about 2 years ago, I implanted an RFID chip inside my left arm.
2 years ago you put the chip in?
March 2006.
Right.
And the funny thing is that I've been traveling around the world talking at conferences about it ever since. And geeks seem to like it. They think it's pretty cool. But the mainstream press has never really noticed. And then just a couple of weeks ago, there was a story about it in The Age, which was in Sydney Morning Herald. And for some reason, that seemed to be the trigger for a press frenzy, which lasted about 36 hours. And during that time, we had several film crews through here. There was a story about it on Channel 10 News, on Channel 7. And we did a live... did some live coverage on Sunrise with Kochi and Mel.
Right.
And I think I did about 18 radio interviews in about 2 days.
What prompted the Fairfax story?
I think that came out of coverage on Slashdot. Oh. So it was like a ladder effect. I started off with an interview that I did at linux.conf.au in January.
Right.
Where I actually did a talk and demonstrated a lot of this technology.
Mm.
And that particular interview was picked up and covered on Slashdot. And then a journalist from Fairfax noticed the Slashdot coverage, so he then wrote a story about it that went into Sydney Morning Herald. From there, it went on to Channel 7 and Channel 10 and just about every radio station in the country.
Yeah, good stuff.
It's been quite bizarre.
Yeah.
So I remember about 12 years ago, I'm guessing, maybe less than that, 10, 12 years ago, when Kevin Warwick, mm-hmm. a university professor in the UK, yes. did something similar to this.
Mm.
And I remember reading his book, and he was in Wire, that sort of stuff.
Mm.
But he had the chip removed, I think, after a couple of years. Then he started doing some stuff about him and his wife trying to send emotions to each other yes. using chips embedded in their arms.
Yeah.
Where did you get the inspiration to do this? Was it from the stuff that Warwick did, or was it just spontaneous?
Well, lots of things. I was certainly aware of the work that Warwick had done. And I'd seen, for example, there's an American guy called Amal Grafstra, I think his name is pronounced, who had done something not long before. And I suppose it was just general awareness of it. I'd also recently installed an RFID access control system at my office. And I was thinking, well, we're carrying around RFID tags. Why can't I just have one implanted rather than have to carry it all the time? Mm. It was also about the time that the Australian passports were modified to have RFID added to them. And that caused a bit of controversy. There was a lot of discussion at the time about whether this was going to lead to, you know, a Big Brother state where we could be tracked if we were carrying our passports,
mm-hmm.
and various things like that. So basically I wanted to learn more about it.
Mm.
And I wanted to learn more about the actual technology itself. So whether RFID technology does enable, you know, a Big Brother state. Also about the regulatory aspect. So if someone wanted to go about implanting something into their body,
yep.
how hard is it to do that and actually follow through the correct channels? I mean, not just going to some backyard person that'll do it for you,
yep.
but, you know, go through a doctor and find a surgeon and have it done. And I also wanted to try to get people thinking about some of the privacy implications as well. So what does it mean if we have RFID everywhere? So those were really the three major things I had in mind.
And so tell people what you've done. We'll get you to show us in a minute. That's sure. why we've got the camera. But so what have you actually done so far to date?
To date? Well, the very first thing I did in terms of modifying my house, this is really, my house is like a big toy box to me. I treat it as something that I modify and to suit my needs. Several years ago, we were wanting to set up a sprinkler system out in the front yard. I went down to the local hardware store and I was looking at sprinkler controllers, and I saw there were quite a few computerized sprinkler controllers. They were about $200 or $300, that sort of region. And they really didn't do all that much. They were basically glorified timers, and you could say, I want you to water at 11 p.m. on Friday, you know, that sort of thing. But it wasn't really that exciting. So what I also found was some $20 electronic timer taps. In fact, I've got one right here. So this is looking pretty old and dirty and beaten up because I've just pulled it out of my garden. But basically, you can go and buy that at your local hardware store for $20-something, and you just set the how often you want it to run and how long you want it to run for. So all I did was open it up, and there's a little timer circuit inside it. I bypassed the timer, fitted a connector on the bottom, so that all I had to do was short the pins on the connector, and the tap would turn on. So at that point, basically, I had myself a $20 electrically controllable tap. From there, it's a very simple matter to have a relay attached to a computer that turns this on or off. And once you've got control of a device in software, you can do pretty much anything with it. So you then have a system that is far more flexible for $20-something and a bit of time than a $200 or $300 timer or controller that really isn't very flexible. So that was really the genesis of all of this. So I started looking around for everyday devices, just random things around the house, and trying to figure out how to connect them to the computer system. And it turns out there are actually lots and lots of things that you can do. The thing that's got most people's attention is the door lock. What I did was got an electric striker plate and...
What's that?
I'll show you actually on the door itself in a moment. But the way a door lock works is there is a moving part, a little bolt, that slides past a fixed plate attached to the side of the door frame. Typically what happens is the bolt is retracted in order to release the lock. An electric striker plate simply replaces the static plate and means that it can be opened electrically. So the door can be opened without having to release the normal mechanical lock. So it adds an extra level of functionality to the lock. And electric striker plates are actually pretty cheap. They're only, you know, in the region of $40-something. You can buy them from JCar or from Bunnings or wherever. All you do is mount it into the door frame in place of the striker plate. So, you know, half an hour's work. If you apply 12 volts to it, the door releases. It's as simple as that. And so what I then did was connect door locks into the computer so the computer could unlock the doors remotely. Now, the thing is that once you've got a device connected to the computer and you have control of that device into the realm of software, you can do just about anything with it. So what I've done is put a little web interface on my home computer system so that with a web browser, I can unlock the front door, which means that from my phone, which has Wi-Fi built into it, I can log onto the house network, I can unlock the front door from my phone. I've even connected it to Second Life so that using a virtual button inside Second Life, I can click on it and the front door will unlock. I mean, that's not very useful necessarily, yeah. But I did that just as a proof of concept. I wanted to show to people that it could be done. I was trying to link, you know, virtual reality into physical reality and have something that occurs in one affect the other.
Yeah.
And I've also connected it up to an RFID reader. So I have an RFID reader mounted next to the door, so I can walk up to the door, scan my arm. The computer recognizes who I am and unlocks the door.
Why don't we go and have a look at that?
Sure.
In a second, so you can show people for the sake of the visual. Mm-hmm. I brought the camera, I might as well use it. For those of you listening in, you're obviously not going to see this, so use your imaginations. And we'll be back to talk with Jonathan shortly about how he went about doing all this. All right, we're back on audio. So for those of you who, for whatever reason, aren't looking at the video, Jonathan just gave me a bit of a tour and showed me how the front door works and his ability to control the lights and the curtains and the bathroom over the web using a PDA or any sort of web interface. So let's go back and we'll cover off some of this again. Mm. So you went to see your GP and said, will you stick this chip the size of a long grain of rice under my arm? And he referred you to another guy, a hand specialist.
That's right.
Who was willing to do it, but mm-hmm. his medical insurance wouldn't allow him to do it.
That's right.
So you had to do it yourself.
I had to do it myself. Technically, we did actually find a way around the medical insurance problem, but that introduced another problem. In Australia, the medical devices are regulated by the TGA, which is the Therapeutic Goods Administration. And there is a special exemption that you can get to have a device approved just as a one-off procedure.
Mm.
One of the requirements is that it has to be pre-approved by the US Food and Drug Administration. And so if you have a device which is approved by the FDA and your doctor says that you need it, then the TGA will basically rubber stamp it. And so we went through all the red tape and we were figuring out how to actually do this. The problem is all the devices approved for use in the US run at the wrong frequency. Everybody else in the world uses an ISO standard frequency, 134.2 kilohertz. The Americans, of course, do everything just a little bit different, and so their implantable tags typically run at 125 kilohertz. So we were in the position where we could have had medical insurance coverage for an American device, but the problem is that that does not comply with the Australian regulations for implantable devices in terms for spectrum allocation. So we could have either complied with the medical requirements or the spectrum allocation requirements, but not both simultaneously.
So you're telling me that RFID chips and readers around the world are running on a single global standard?
They generally are, except in the US.
Which is, jeez. That's...
It's a little bit crazy.
In this day and age, to approach this sort of a massive change without having some sort of uniformity seems insane.
Yeah.
So you did it yourself. So you got one of these little injection devices, basically a needle that the vets use, and you somehow managed to stick it under your skin and put it in. So we were talking a little bit too before about the process of building it. You've built your own RFID reader for the door. And basically, again, for people who didn't watch the video, Jonathan's able to walk up to the door, stick his wrist where he's got the RFID chip against the RFID reader on the door, and it unlocks his door. In terms of getting the components for these, for somebody who doesn't have a background in software programming or electrical engineering, how complex is it to put something like this together today?
It actually turned out to be a little bit harder than I expected. I have a background both in electronics and in software.
So I guess
hardware and software. And if you just want to play with the 125 kilohertz tags, there is heaps of stuff out there. You can buy, you know, for $30, $40, you can buy a little pre-built module that does everything for you. It's even got the antenna in it. All you do is apply power and it just, you bring a tag near it and it outputs a stream containing the code in the tag. It's as easy as that. And they are very commonly available because 125 kilohertz is used in the US. To actually work with the ISO standard implantable tags. It's a little bit more difficult and generally more expensive. You can buy a commercial reader. This particular device here, which you can't see because it's not on video, is a reader that's typically used by a vet. And they're in the region of $400 or $500.
It looks like a prop out of 1960 Star Trek.
It looks like
something Bones would use to diagnose a disease.
It sure does. It looks like a very dodgy piece of equipment, actually. But it looks like the sort of thing you find in a show bag.
Yes, it does.
But it actually does work. And they're moderately expensive. By expensive, you know, $400 or $500 type region, which is quite expensive as far as these sorts of things go. What I had to do was order in a special chipset from Germany, which was manufactured by a company that actually supplies the chips to the manufacturers of these devices. And when you're dealing with RFID, there are a number of different techniques or technologies that you have to take into consideration. There are things like the actual antenna itself is a coil, so you need to power up the coil at the correct frequency. You need to have a system that understands the modulation scheme used by the particular chip and the particular implantable tag. And there are multiple encoding schemes. Once you actually start looking into it, there are a whole lot of technical hiccups along the way.
So before I my head explodes with all of that, why do you think this isn't something that's more commonly available commercially today? Why aren't manufacturers building houses with these in? Do you have any concerns about security? How hackable is this if somebody wanted to hack your RFID reader on your front door?
Yeah, well, that is definitely an issue. That was one of the things that I was really wanting to learn as well while I was investigating this technology. And one of the things I've discovered is that for the vast majority of RFID tags, there is no security at all. The only reason that they have any security is because not very many people have the knowledge of how it works. And so it seems like magic. Like for a typical commercial building, if you have an access control system, a lot of people have an access control card, you know, the size of a credit card. You walk up, you hold it near the door unlocks.
Mm-hmm.
As far as 99.9% of the population is concerned, that's magic.
Mm.
The fact is that it's actually incredibly low tech. You can read them from a distance. You can scan someone's card without them even knowing. Like you can scan it while it's in their pocket. Once you've got the code on it, you can then reproduce it. And this sort of technology really is not very secure. There are some serious issues with it.
Mm.
Some of the early technology, it simply had no concept of security built into the design.
Mm.
It wasn't a problem. It just wasn't part of the design spec. For some of the newer tags, they actually have built-in public key authentication. And one of the problems, for example, if you're carrying an access card in your pocket and you're in, you know, you're in the underground or on the train or whatever, you don't know if someone walks past you with an RFID reader in their pocket, it could scan your tag, grab the code, and you'll never even know. And that's because the tags will authenticate themselves to anything. If a reader walks up to it and says, give me your code, it'll give it the code. And that's just the way the system is designed to work.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the tags actually have reader authentication built into them.
Right.
So they will not identify themselves unless the reader actually provides it a code. So the reader has to authenticate itself first.
Mm-hmm.
Even that is not enough in terms of security, because what you can do is sniff the communications between a tag and a trusted reader. So if you are sitting near the door of a high security building with a high sensitivity antenna, you could in theory be reading the codes of everybody that goes in into the building, and you could then replay them. So some of the newer tags also have encryption built into it. So not only will they authenticate the reader, but they will actually encrypt the communication, similar to when you log into a secure website.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea is that the communications between your browser and the web server are encrypted, so nobody along the way can see your credit card numbers as they travel down the internet.
Mm.
It's the same thing. The message is encrypted so that even if you're sitting there with a sensitive antenna reading the signal, you can't tell what's actually going on inside that message.
So that's probably one reason why they're not more commercially available today in houses, because of the security issues.
I think, look
in Victoria, look, the last couple of years they've been trying to roll out these digital MET cards, and it's, you know, 5 years late, and it's cost them hundreds of millions of dollars more than they had budgeted. And I believe that security is a large part of that.
It probably is, yeah. I don't think that's entirely the explanation, though. I think it's partly just a matter of technology filtering down as the price point falls.
Mm-hmm.
The fact is that an RFID reader for a door is in the order of multiple hundreds of dollars at the moment, then you've got to add the striker plate, and you need some kind of a computer system potentially to run it. So it adds a little bit of cost to the building.
Mm-hmm.
And this technology is obviously practical. We see it on commercial buildings. We just don't see it on residential buildings. But it is starting to filter down. So we're now seeing it on, it's common in hotels, for example. They've mm-hmm. used this sort of stuff for years because they have obviously highly transient population. So they need to be able to cancel keys and do things like that. There are some big convenience factors. But also, I think it's simply lack of knowledge among builders and architects. It's one of these situations where people haven't really been exposed to it. They don't know it's possible. So they simply don't spec it when they're designing a home.
Yeah. And is it hard to retrofit after a home has been built without going to extreme trouble?
Not particularly difficult. One of the biggest issues is getting cable into the right places. Mm. And that's one of the reasons that we're doing it now in the midst of a big renovation.
Yeah.
When you're ripping out walls and moving plaster around, that's the perfect time. You can just run cable wherever you like. So yeah. I'm taking this as an opportunity to put in cable for everything I can think of, whether I'm about to do it or not. It doesn't matter. I'll stick the cable in the wall.
Yeah.
And that is definitely an issue. There are some ways you can retrofit to existing buildings. So the buildings with particular problems are obviously things like brick buildings where you have trouble getting inside the wall, but also older homes where you don't necessarily want to... heritage homes, for example, this sort of thing can be a real problem. Doing any sort of electrical work in those sorts of environments can be a problem.
Yeah.
There are some technologies to get around it. A lot based on radio connections. I personally try to go for hardwired stuff as much as I possibly can.
Yeah.
And if you talk to anybody that's worked in TV broadcasting or something like that, and they've had to deal with radio mics, if you have to cable up microphones and you have wires everywhere, and everybody says, well, radio mics are the ultimate solution, but they're not, because you get interference, you get reliability issues, you have battery problems. Basically, nothing beats wire for getting a signal from one place to another.
I can't even get my Bluetooth keyboard and mouse to work reliably.
Exactly. So, we have this utopian dream that we won't have wires anywhere. All the devices will just talk to each other wirelessly.
Mm.
But it does introduce big practical problems.
Mm-hmm.
So my preference is cable everything possible.
Mm.
Even around the house, I've got gigabit Ethernet cable to basically every room in the house.
Mm.
And, my friends say, just run wireless. I'm like, well, wireless is okay, but it's not perfect.
Yeah.
Nothing beats cable.
Yeah. Okay. So we shouldn't be expecting to see this stuff in our homes in the next couple of years. What do you think the time frame is before this stuff's going to be filtering down to a consumer level?
At the top end, it's already becoming available. And what we're seeing... So I was talking earlier about the price point. One of the difficulties is that as you're wiring a house, you have to run multiple types of cable. And the more types of cable you have to run, the more expensive it is. If you have Sparkies who are doing runs of Cat 5 plus 2.5 mil twin and earth for mains power plus 1 mil for lighting, whatever, every type of cable you introduce adds cost. And so what we're starting to see at the moment are what's called structured cabling systems, where a whole lot of different cable types are being combined into one. And it means that you can just drag the same cable pretty much everywhere. It's being used more now on very high-end properties, commercial buildings and things like that, where you see a lot of commercial automation systems like CBUS or Dynalite, which are used for the very big systems. Like if you're wiring up a university, for example, you'd use smart cabling, definitely. A lot of those use Dynalite or CBUS or similar technologies. And it's just getting to the tipping point now where the price is almost on a parity to cable a house using old-style discrete cabling versus the new-style structured cabling.
Right.
And once it hits that tipping point, basically everybody is going to go to structured cabling, and all of a sudden it's going to become the norm. I suspect that what we're going to see is that we will have that tipping point effect, where it will get down to a certain point in the market, it becomes cheaper to install structured cabling, and then it will just be everywhere. And that will really open the way for a whole lot of devices that rely on that basic infrastructure.
Yep.
Because if you don't have the infrastructure in place, it's silly trying to install, a particular device that has automation capabilities. Mm. So automation will then become much more common.
We've been hearing for years and years and years now that every electronic device is going to have an IP address and a microprocessor built into it, and we're going to be able to control everything. But I haven't been seeing a lot of progress in my daily life.
That's right. And I think that is largely an infrastructure thing. It really, if you have a device, say you manufacture a fridge and you wanted to have it be able to report to a central system what temperature it's at, or if it's broken down, it needs to raise an alert or something like that. It costs, you know, in the order of $10 at the manufacturing level to add an Ethernet connection and a little web server and a bit of intelligence to the device. It's really actually quite small. The problem is that the infrastructure isn't there, and that houses just aren't wired for these sorts of devices. So that's really what's holding it back. We need the low-level infrastructure in place before the devices can start appearing to take advantage of it.
Okay. Well, Jonathan, thanks for the chat.
Thanks, Cameron.
Fascinating stuff. Oh, before we finish, one thing I wanted to ask you is about body modification, because that's the other side of this.
Yes. Right?
I'm sure there's a lot of people who are appalled at the thought of you injecting an electronic device into your body. Although, people get pacemakers every day of the week, and there seems to be certain forms of body modification that we've become comfortable with over the last 4 or 5 decades.
Yes.
Other things that people are still horrified about. Did you have any personal struggles with the idea of injecting a piece of electronics into your body?
I did.
Apart from the pure health level stuff.
Ethical issues. I did. But one point I should make, you were alluding to this, is as a medical procedure goes, it's actually relatively trivial. I've had a lot of people have a very shocked reaction. I tell them what I've done, and it's as if I'm the Antichrist or I've done something really gory and extreme to my body. But the fact is that having an RFID chip implanted is a less invasive procedure than a lot of body piercing. So you see someone with a tongue piercing, for example, the tongue has lots of major blood vessels in it. It's a muscle. And it's very sensitive. That is a far more dangerous operation than what I've done. And yet you see people with tongue piercings all the time. I mean, even piercing your ears is not a lot different to what I've done.
Not to mention other parts of the anatomy that
people
that I don't even want to think about.
No one even goes there.
It's fairly regular, I'm led to believe.
So, yeah, as a procedure goes, it's actually not that extreme. I certainly did have... think twice or three times or four times about it before I did it. It was quite a long time between investigating it and deciding to do it and actually doing it.
Are there other forms of body modification that you're wanting to do, you're looking forward to?
There are lots of things that I think could be modified, but this is it's a very interesting area. It's something that I personally pay a lot of attention to, but there really isn't very much right now that is practical. And one of the big problems, of course, with modifying your body is that if something goes wrong, it can have serious ramifications, and you can't. There's no undo button. A great example is this particular chip that I have in my arm. This, as modifications go, this is about as small as you can get. And the ideal site for this would be between my thumb and forefinger. The problem is that this technology is going obsolete at an incredible rate, and upgrades. When an upgrade involves a scalpel, you suddenly start to think twice about it. And even a very simple medical procedure involves development of scar tissue and things like that. So if, for example, I had a tag inserted between my thumb and forefinger, and then later on I wanted to upgrade it, it's not just a matter of cutting it out and putting a new one in. There is scar tissue to deal with, and you have cumulative effects over time.
Right.
So you have to think ahead. It's not just an impulse decision. So one of the reasons that I put it in my arm was specifically because I knew that this was not going to be a chip that would do me forever. Ultimately, I want things like mass storage and encryption. I'd like to be able, for example, to have my entire home directory stored on the chip. So I could walk up to a computer, put my hand on the keyboard, and my home directory is mounted. Just like carrying a USB key, but you don't have to carry it. I mean, all of this sort of stuff is coming, and there are chips now with rewritable storage in them, but the capacity is extremely low.
Of course, all of your storage should be in the cloud anyway. It'll be on
ultimately
Amazon's S3 servers
or something like that. Yeah.
Okay. Fabulous.
Thanks, John. Great. Thank you.